in this edition of The Spotlight. Thanking my guest, Seta Kofi, broadcaster and media consultant in London, and also Fra Hughes, author and journalist in Belfast. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories: a recent security pact between Morocco and Israel is drawing criticism, with Hamas calling it a great sin against the cause of Palestine. A new coronavirus variant found in South Africa and designated a variant of concern, already making its way into several European countries. Also ahead, Asians complain about being treated as unwelcome guests in Britain. New reports from a protest in London. Coming up. Welcome to World News. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas calls on Morocco to sever ties with Israel after Rabat signed a security deal with the regime. Hamas has condemned the agreement as a great sin against the Palestinian cause. It says the move is against the strategic goals of the Arab world and cannot be justified under any pretexts. On Wednesday, Morocco and Israel signed an agreement for security, intelligence, and military cooperation between the two sides. The agreement was signed during a visit by the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, to the North African country. Morocco normalized its ties with the Israeli regime last year under a U.S. brokered deal. The decision by Britain to ban the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, as well as Australia's blacklisting of Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah, has drawn condemnations. The two groups have slammed the moves and vowed to continue to fight against the Israeli regime's crimes and violations. Here's a report.
A plot to silence anti-Israel resistance groups. This is what many describe the latest move by Australia and the UK to blacklist Lebanese and Palestinian resistance movements. Canberra announced this decision on Wednesday.
Today I'm announcing my intention to list the base and the entirety of Hezbollah as terrorist organisations under the criminal code. Now, listing these organisations sends a very strong message that Australia condemns the use of terrorism to achieve political, ideological or religious objectives.
In 2003, Australia blacklisted Hezbollah's military wing, but Wednesday's decision expanded the list to include the group's political wing, which is a powerful player in Lebanon's politics, with seats in parliament and cabinet. On November 19, the British government did the same with the political wing of Hamas, joining the United States, Canada, and the European Union in fully banning the group.
And today, I have laid an order in the United Kingdom Parliament to amend Schedule 2 of the Terrorism Act 2000 to proscribe Hamas in its entirety, including its political wing.
The decisions have been slammed by resistance groups, with Hamas calling Britain's move unlawful.
The decision is a crime against the Palestinian people and against its historical struggle. This is a condemnation of our right to defend ourselves. It is a political and ethical mistake and unlawful by Britain, added to its first crime, when they had the Balfour Declaration. This step is to satisfy the occupation.
Hezbollah has also denounced Australia's move. Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah says the decision to blacklist the group will not affect its resolve and determination.
Putting the name of Hezbollah into the list of terrorist organizations may be due to regional developments or parliamentary election. However, such designations will not affect the determination of the resistance, nor the support for it.
Both Hezbollah and Hamas have been fighting against the Israeli regime's occupation of their lands for decades. Hezbollah was established following the 1982 Israeli invasion and occupation of southern Lebanon. The movement drove out Israeli forces from Lebanon in May 2000, though Tel Aviv still occupies parts of Lebanon. Hamas also plays a significant role in defending Palestinian rights against frequent Israeli aggressions. The U.S. has already blacklisted both groups to appease the Israeli regime, which was created and nourished by Washington and its Western allies. Australia, the U.S., and Britain are now in a trilateral security pact and are not the only main suppliers of weapons to Israel, but regularly vote against anti-Israeli resolutions at the U.N. Their latest moves have exposed their intentions even further, as they have chosen to support the aggressors at the expense of the victims.
Next, hashtag trending brings you social media reactions to the systematic harassment of Palestinians at the hands of the Zionist regime.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. Today, we'll explore a recurring topic, which is the issue of Palestine and the daily harassment that the residents of this historical land are subjected to. Stay tuned. This has been all over the news this past couple of days. A doctor from the Gaza Strip who had lost his three young daughters and a nephew in an Israeli shelling all the way back in 2009 lost his last Israeli court appeal for compensation. But the grieving father says that he won't back down and he will continue to seek justice in an international forum. Our hearts go out to you, Izzet.
Do we need to come to prove that we are victims? Or the perpetrator to acknowledge what happened?
Izzet didn't have high expectations. He just wanted for the killers of his innocent daughters to admit to their crimes and apologize, something that the Israeli judicial system has deprived him of ever since. But let's move on to some of your comments and see your reactions to the story. The first one comes from W.M. Fussfield. It reads, "Is as painful as it is important to watch. These are the kind of horrors that the Zionist terrorists promulgate continuously while Western mainstream media remains shamelessly and cravenly silent and Western governments act in complicity with Israel. That they do." Abdurrahim wrote, "There is no justice to be found for Palestinians in Zionist settler occupation courts." Our next tweet comes from Obeid Baluch. It reads, "Apartheid state is made on the graves of innocent Palestinians." On to our next one, which comes from Sagir Hussein Khan. It reads, "This is the real face of the so-called only democracy of the Middle East. Even the court is systematically helping to implement apartheid." True, but it's equally important to know that Israel would never have gotten to this point if it wasn't for the foreign support that they're getting, which comes in many shapes and forms. Just like how Meta, aka Facebook, has been blocking pages that belong to Palestinian journalists, activists, and people on its platform. And that's exactly the reason for the launch of a campaign called Facebook Censors Jerusalem Al-Quds. Luckily, Hashtag Trending here is willing to do what Meta isn't willing to do, which is spreading the news about the Palestinian plights at the hands of Israel. Let's continue. Quds News Network tweeted, "Activists take part in the weekly protest in support of the Palestinian citizens of Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds, who are under threat of eviction in favor of colonial Israeli settlers. Hashtag Facebook censors Jerusalem Al-Quds." Our next tweet comes from Clara Goetz. She wrote, Israeli forces targeted journalists with rubber-coated metal bullets and tear gas bombs while they were covering protests in Nablus, wounding several of them. Hashtag journalism. Palestine will be free, tweeted. Four Palestinian protesters were injured by Israeli gunfire during the weekly anti-colonization march in the village of Kafr Qadum in the occupied West Bank. Check it out. Now, despite all these protests and the outside pressure from free media and the public opinion, Israel's leaders continue to evict Palestinians and raise their homes. And now there are talks about Israel intensifying its colonization program, which is often referred to as the most dangerous invasion in decades, which involves the construction of thousands of settler units in the occupied East Al-Quds. Let's move on to the next comment by MX Revenge. It reads, crazy tsunami, Israel plans most dangerous invasion in decades in Al-Quds. Alaa Daragmeh wrote, Qalandiyya village, Jerusalem, Al-Quds municipality approved the creation of a new settlement, 9,000 housing units and 1,243 dunams of land. Each dunam equals 900 square meters. North of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, which is set to be located at the site of the Qalandiyya airport between the Kufr Aqab and Qalandiyya village. Check it out. So they're approving construction on land they don't even own. Yeah, that makes sense, yeah? Syria Online tweeted, Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. I mean, that is about as obvious as it can get. Our final comment of the day comes from David Moses on Press TV's website. Israel keeps on grabbing more and more of Palestine, yet Western countries are blind and dumb. Western countries should start talking about the immediate nuclear disarmament of Israel. That's going to be it for me and this edition of Hashtag Trending. Don't go anywhere. The rest of world news is next.
Concerns rising over the latest coronavirus variant called Omicron, Australia now joining the list of countries that have confirmed cases of the strain. Health officials say the strain was found after testing two passengers from South Africa who flew into Sydney on Saturday. The Omicron has already been detected or suspected in several countries, including the UK and Germany. It has a large number of mutations with worrying characteristics. The World Health Organization says the Omicron is potentially more contagious than the previous variants. Countries are scrambling to curb its spread by enforcing travel curbs.
South African airports have become a scene of stranded passengers with cancelled flights as the world races to contain the new concerning COVID-19 variant called Omicron. While inconvenient in nature, the bans have drawn mixed reactions from people most affected by the restrictions.
I'm not happy with the situation because I booked my flight on time. Everything was on time. Now I'm inconvenienced because I had to be at work tomorrow, but then they cancelled the flight. After cancelling the flight, if I arrive in the UK, because I'm quarantining in Frankfurt, if I arrive in the UK after 4 p.m., I have to quarantine in a hotel on my cost for 10 days. I don't have the money, I don't have the £2,000 to quarantine in the hotel.
The countries that are banning South Africans out have higher rates than we currently do. So I don't think it's totally fair, but I get that countries are just trying to protect themselves and their citizens.
Meanwhile, South Africa, enraged by the restrictions, says it is being punished for being the first country to detect and report the strain, which the World Health Organization has termed a variant of concern.
Based upon the information that we have, particularly from South Africa, they have advised WHO that this variant should be classified as a variant of concern.
Following the discovery, several countries have not only imposed restrictions, but also logged their first cases of the Omicron variant. The British government on Saturday announced new precautionary measures after two Omicron cases were detected in the country.
We will require all contacts of those who test positive with a suspected case of Omicron to self-isolate for 10 days, regardless of your vaccination status. We will also go further in asking all of you to help contain the spread of this variant by tightening up the rules on face coverings in shops and on public transport.
Elsewhere in Europe, Germany reported two cases of the Omicron variant in the state of Bavaria. In Italy, officials registered the first case of the new strain in a traveler from Mozambique. The Czech Republic and the Netherlands have each also reported one suspected case of the new strain. Meanwhile, Hungary says it will impose restrictions on travelers from seven African countries. This comes while EU member states had already agreed to impose restrictions on all travel from South Africa. Iran halted travel from African countries including South Africa, Mozambique, Namibia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Lesotho, and Eswatini until further notice. Several other countries, including Australia, the US, Brazil, and Guatemala, have either forced several travel restrictions already or are set to impose such bans this week. While scientists are still learning about the variant, the news has already taken a toll on the global economy amid fears of what the new travel bans would do to the economy still reeling from its falls in 2019. Since its emergence, COVID-19, which has claimed over 5,190,000 lives out of nearly 261 million cases, has gone through several mutations. But considering the human body's ability to fight new strains of the virus and the immunity provided by vaccines, officials across the globe continue to push for jabs in the world's fight against the pandemic.
November 27th marks the first anniversary of Israel's assassination of prominent Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. That was part of Israel's long-running objectives to hamper advancements made in Iran's nuclear program. But anti-Iran plots have proven ineffective as Tehran continues to make progress with its peaceful nuclear program.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the former head of the Iranian Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated on November 27, 2020, when the car he was riding in came under attack near his countryside residence east of Tehran. Fakhrizadeh had reportedly been on Israel's hit list since at least 2007.
This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Abad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
But he wasn't the only Iranian scientist to have been targeted by Israel. The regime made several assassination attempts between 2007 and 2012 that claimed the lives of four nuclear scientists and wounded another. That's on top of sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear sites that have become more frequent over the past months. Iran has vowed to continue the work on its peaceful nuclear program. The international community, however, was largely silent over the recent assassination, a similar attitude of indifference that's displayed toward Israel's airstrikes on Syria and its aggression on the Palestinian people.
The point is simple. Israel is America's most important friend and ally in the Middle East and in North Africa. Israel is exempt from prosecution in the eyes of America, simply because without Israel, America's position in the Middle East and in North Africa would be in serious jeopardy.
Iran has vowed a harsh response against those behind the attacks on Iranian nuclear scientists and sites.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
The Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
the limelight. Facing economic and environmental pressures, coal plants are closing across the United States, leaving communities to work out how to keep afloat. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Matt Krupnik. The piece is titled, What Happens When America's Coal Plants Die? Facing economic and environmental pressures, coal plants are closing across the United States, leaving communities to work out how to keep afloat. When the coal-fired power plant just outside the tiny town of New Clare, Colorado, closed in 2019, it had the makings of a disaster. The plant, which opened in 1959, shut down 3 years ahead of schedule when it ran out of coal, leaving the town shocked and facing the loss of its largest employer. The facility provided nearly half of the tax revenue to the region, said Deanna Sheriff, executive director of the West End Economic Development Corporation, which serves New Clare and the surrounding area between Telluride and Grand Junction in western Colorado. Left without vital funding for its fire department and school district, the town was terrified about its future. But despite the early plant closure and an unemployment rate that more than doubled overnight, New Clare had done enough to prepare. The town has leaned on tourism, driven by outdoor activities and the recent opening of dozens of small businesses to survive. Initially, we saw a lot of frustration and concern, mostly about selling homes and folks moving away, Sheriff said. But the town has adapted fairly well, she said. We've diversified our economy enough, and we're not going to die because one industry went away. Increasingly outpaced by cheaper alternatives, including renewable energies, and under pressure from climate concerns, at least 24 U.S. coal power plants, many of them in small rural communities, are expected to close down or downsize over the next 10 years, as are most of the coal mines that supply them, according to the Environmental Protection Agency and experts. Most coal communities face the same challenges as New Clare, Colorado. How to place the jobs and tax dollars that have kept these towns afloat for decades. In some cases, such as New Clare, Colorado, local officials started planning early. In others, the closures appear to have taken leaders by surprise. The huge Navajo generating station in northern Arizona, within the Navajo Nation, also shut down in 2019. Local leaders complained that plant operators closed the facilities decades ahead of schedule, although the region did have 2 years to prepare after the announcement. Little planning appears to have preceded the closure of the plant. What does prepare mean? Said the Coconino County Supervisor Lena Fowler. Regional leaders didn't see many options for replacing the money and jobs as the closure loomed, she said. The lack of preparation in Arizona, compounded by the subsequent pandemic that shut down tourism in the picturesque region near the Grand Canyon, and a drought that has devastated the popular boating destination, Lake Powell, has had dire consequences. Coconino County has lost $40 million a year in property taxes since the plant just outside the town of Page closed, Fowler said. Families have been separated as one parent left for a job at another power plant, and there are concerns the Navajo Nation could cut essential services because of the tax losses. A second Navajo power plant, Four Corners, is due to close in the next decade, as is the Chola plant just outside of the Navajo Nation. A nearby coal mine on the Hopi Reservation, which supplied the Navajo generating station, has also closed down. The Navajo Nation president, Jonathan Ness, did not respond to an interview request. The Navajo Nation didn't do enough planning, said Nicole Hosenherder, a Navajo water rights activist who leads the To Mijoni Aniup environmental non-profit organization. They should have been planning for this the day the coal plant signed the leases. We can't just be dependent on something we knew wasn't going to last forever. Cultural and regional differences have a huge bearing on how communities prepare and recover from a coal plant closure. Secluded towns that have relied on coal for decades, including power plant jobs that pay an average of $90,000 a year or more, can be reluctant to talk about a coal-free future, and don't even bring up solar or wind power in some places. Renewable energies for the workforce there are the antichrist, said Clint McRae, who owns the Rocker 6 cattle company near the Colstrip coal power plant in Montana, and is a member of the Northern Plains Resource Council, an advocacy group that fights for water quality protections. Some communities remain very loyal to coal and consider energy sources such as solar and wind power as a threat to their way of life. It's a very difficult subject to talk about over there. It's going to take time to absorb in the community, McRae said. The Colstrip plant is scheduled to be retired in 2025, according to its operator's latest estimates. And Clint McRae and others worry about the pollution it will leave behind. Like other power plants, Colstrip has been collecting coal ash, a toxic byproduct, in ponds. That pollution has seeped into the groundwater of the region. Coal ash can often be the most dangerous legacy of a closed plant. In 2014, 39,000 tons of coal ash and 27 million gallons of contaminated water from a plant owned by Duke Energy that had closed 2 years earlier spilled into North Carolina's Dan River. Duke Energy has two other plants in North Carolina's Person County that are expected to close within 6 years. Among those who have tried to get the community to transition its coal-based economy is State Senator Mike Woodard, who admits it's been a tough hill to climb in an area that has yet to accept the reality of coal's future. Person County is going to have to accept that there is a new way of doing business there, said Senator Woodard, a Democrat who helped negotiate the state's recently enacted clean energy law. Renewable energy, not coal, is the future, he added. We're all going to be in the same rowboat together, and it will be great if we were rowing in the same direction. Some states have done better than others helping to row the boat. With a slew of coal closures coming to Colorado, the state has established an office to help communities plan for transition. Led by Director Wade Buchanan, the Office of Just Transition has tried to steer local officials and residents away from a coal versus renewables argument and to think about the transition in more economic terms. Buchanan compares the transition to that faced by timber communities in the Pacific Northwest, which successfully transformed their economy when lumber mills began to close. I think we make a mistake thinking about this as a uniquely coal-related or uniquely energy-related, Buchanan said. There is a culture factor that makes it unique, but when you step back and think about how to transition away from this, there are other places that have relied on one industry or employer for a while. Buchanan points out to Nuclear Colorado as an example of how to manage that transition effectively, with more than 100 diverse small businesses opening in the area since the power plant closed, thanks in part to tax breaks and other financial incentives. States and outsiders need to let rural communities figure out their own transitions, he said.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
For 10 years, dozens of countries have been trying to overthrow the Syrian government. It's not just the United States and its Western allies. Arab countries in the Middle East have also been implicated in this plan. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others took an active role in the war on Syria, throwing money, weapons, and unlimited support behind various terrorist groups. Other Arab countries, like Egypt and Jordan, stood idly by, distancing themselves from Syria and passively towing the official narrative that President Bashar al-Assad must be removed. Fast forward to 2021, and now those same countries are trying to normalize ties with the Syrian government. Ostensibly, the United States is fuming as its regional allies in the Middle East seek rapprochement with Damascus. So why now? What's the strategy here? Are these countries acting on their own accord, or did they get the prior okay first from Washington? How come these countries want to buddy up again with Syria, and how does it benefit both sides? Aside from trying to topple the Syrian government, the United States has claimed since 2014 that it's busy launching limited precision strikes against Daesh inside Iraq and Syria. Is it? That's not what the latest investigation by the New York Times says. A recent report shows that U.S. forces killed dozens of Syrian women and children in 2019 and then tried covering it up, literally, by bulldozing the site so no one would find out. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The war on Syria began in 2011 during the protests of the Arab Spring. While Egypt and Tunisia experienced enormous popular uprisings, that's not quite what happened in Libya and Syria. Syria had protests to a certain degree, but it quickly became apparent who and what was behind these calls to topple the government. It wasn't just Syrians out on the streets protesting, seeking change and an overhaul of the system. It was also foreign governments trying to change the political landscape in the Middle East, who were meddling inside Syria and trying to bring about regime change. These foreign governments and their terrorist proxies soon proved to be the most dominant actors in the war on Syria. The United States, United Kingdom, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Israel, Turkey, and many others were sending money, arms, and training terrorist groups inside Syria. This is a well-documented fact. These same countries tried to isolate Syria in the international community and the United Nations. Syria's diplomatic ties have been severed with dozens of countries. The list is too long to mention. And they put Syria under heavy sanctions, both the U.S. and the European Union. Many cut ties, and that was that. Syria was isolated, and still is today to an extraordinary degree. Syria, whose nickname in Arabic is Qalb al-Arub al-Nabida, the beating heart of Arabism, was even kicked out of the Arab League. That's how much the politics in the region were manipulated against Syria. The Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, was smuggling weapons from Libya to Syria to support terrorist groups fighting the government. But some Arab countries were also supporting their own groups in Syria. Qatar was funding terrorist groups like Falaq al-Rahman or Jabhat al-Nusra, which is essentially a rebrand of Al-Qaeda. Meanwhile, the Saudis threw their support behind organizations like Jaish al-Islam and Ahrar al-Sham. Fast forward to 2021, and now the situation is completely different. Despite throwing all this money and sending all these foreign fighters to Syria, it didn't work. The last couple of months, we've seen an extraordinary shift as many Arab countries have indicated their willingness for rapprochement with Damascus. A country like Saudi Arabia, which was funding terrorist groups to overthrow the Syrian government, is now saying it wants to mend ties with Syria as if nothing happened. Just look at this example from a few months ago in June from Al Jazeera. They reported Saudi Arabia is close to reaching an agreement on diplomatic normalization with President Bashar al-Assad's government. Incredible, isn't it? In September, Egypt and Jordan, who weren't on speaking terms with Syria since the beginning of the war, are now suddenly cooperating with al-Assad so they can send Egyptian gas and Jordanian power through Syria to help Lebanon. This was done at the behest of the United States, scared that Hezbollah was growing too popular in Lebanon. Later that same month, Reuters reported that Jordan's King Abdullah received a phone call from Syrian President al-Assad, the first since the start of the war in 2011. A week later, in early October, Jordan proceeded to open its main border crossing with Syria. During the latest UN General Assembly in New York, the Syrian foreign minister had meetings not just with the Egyptian foreign minister, but eight other Arab foreign ministers. The latest sign of normalization came in early November from the United Arab Emirates. The foreign minister of the UAE, Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed, came to Damascus to meet with al-Assad personally. Given all these recent developments, there's no doubt that we're seeing a huge shift in attitude from Arab countries towards Syria. But why is that exactly? To talk more, I wanted to bring on Tim Anderson. He joins me from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Tim is an Australian writer, activist, and academic. He's also the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, a virtual network that was founded over concerns of academic body censorship on anti-imperial research. Tim, thanks so much for taking the time. It's a pleasure to have you on. So the first thing I wanted to talk about is the rapprochement or normalization of ties with Syria. What do you think is behind this change in attitude? What has changed the equation here? Is it the president, the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, or perhaps the advance of Yemeni forces as the Houthis are part of the resistance axis? Why exactly are we seeing so many Arab countries change their position in regards to Syria?
Yes, it's related to the whole region. You're right in that respect. And of course, the U.S. has always seen the whole region as its project, not individual wars. You know, there have been at least eight wars, arguably nine if we include Bahrain, in the last 20 years. And that's part of a project that was given a name, the New Middle East, 15 years ago by Condoleezza Rice when she was in Jerusalem just before the Israelis invaded Lebanon again. So what's been happening is they've been losing several wars, as you mentioned. They withdrew from Afghanistan. They have a schedule to withdraw what they call combat troops from Iraq. You know, that may be weasel words there. They are certainly in discussions at the moment to withdraw troops from Syria. And as you pointed out, the Saudis are in trouble in Yemen, and they've been suing for peace for the last couple of years, but they haven't proposed any decent sort of terms. So I think in that context, and also in the context of the contradictions of the economic blockade, let's not call them sanctions, the economic blockade against most of the independent countries here and the peoples of the region here, the U.S. is, or the Biden administration, let's say, has had to start to make some adjustments. It made some adjustments for Lebanon when the country was on the verge of starving and not having any fuel. There was pressure from the Emiratis, who actually went and normalized with Damascus 3 years ago. And then Trump, of course, used that against them to force them to normalize with Israel. He blackmailed them on that one. But nevertheless, the Emiratis wanted to get back, and having lost the war of all the proxy armies they'd sent into Syria, some of those countries really, for their own reasons of investment and trade and whatever, wanted to reestablish ties with Syria and not be completely excluded. And so Jordan was the other one. Jordan, probably the weakest of all of the Arab countries, totally dependent on its relationship with the US, also did some sort of normalization recently. So I think you're seeing them, the UAE to a certain extent, certainly Jordan and Lebanon, getting permission from the US to reopen ties to a certain degree, against what the very strong third-party economic blockade measures that Trump put in place called the Caesar sanctions. So the Biden administration has not removed those laws, but it's been making exceptions more or less while maintaining the framework of a large number of laws that constitute this blockade.
And that's a very interesting point, because I wanted to ask you about that. Do you think they're acting of their own accord, or they had to get an okay from the United States and Israel? Because, you know, it is a contradiction in how the United States views Syria and how they view Syria now.
Yes, the U.S. Certainly gave permission to Jordan, and I believe also to the Emiratis. Their foreign minister was here recently. It was a big deal. It was a diplomatic coup for Syria in a way. It was also a type of a green light for the Emiratis to proceed with investment projects, which they've been looking at. And they have some in train that they've been holding back for the last 3 years, but I believe that's now going ahead. So I think they needed permission from the U.S. Of course, remember, all of these collaborating states are very vulnerable to the U.S., and Trump proved that when he forced the Emiratis and Bahrain, wasn't it, to recognize Israel, the so-called, some agreement where they...
Abraham Accords. Yeah.
Abraham Accords, that's right, yeah.
When Blinken, the Secretary of State, he says that the United States opposes any attempts to rehabilitate or normalize ties with Syria, is he just puffing his chest?
Yes, well, that's happening to a certain degree. I mean, it is bluster, but it's also, they know they've been fighting a losing war in Syria and Iraq for a number of years now. They they don't mind making exceptions for certain people, and by which they still hold the power to prevent things from happening, basically. But, it appears that there's big contradictions, because the Lebanese are coming in, the Jordanians are coming in, the Emiratis are coming in. The Saudis have been talking to Damascus also.
Right.
But that's not really out in the open yet. But nevertheless, the U.S. is maintaining its posture that of a bad loser. I mean, they're always bad losers, aren't they? You know, I recall Vietnam. They fought for at least 7 years, knowing that they were losing in Vietnam. Then they imposed so-called sanctions, a blockade on Vietnam for a number of years too, which persisted into the 80s. You know, so that's why I wouldn't be surprised to see the occupation, U.S. occupation. Remember, there's three occupations of Syria now. The two largest NATO armies, Turkey and the U.S., are occupying large parts of Syria, and of course Israel has been occupying the southern part for 50 years. So. The U.S. occupation is all along the border, the critical borders of Syria, on the eastern borders with Iraq and also with Jordan, except for one point where al-Baghouz is. So one of the key points of the U.S. occupation, I believe, is to prevent the links strengthening between Iran, Iraq, and Syria. That's really quite a critical part of their classical divide and rule strategy.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
mentioned the massacre, which was unearthed by the New York Times recently. This article talks about a U.S. airstrike inside Syria near a town called Behruz. On March 18th, 2019, American forces killed upwards of 60 Syrian civilians. Let me just read you a few lines from the article. A U.S. military drone circled high overhead, hunting for military targets, but it saw only a large crowd of women and children huddled against a riverbank. Without warning, an American F-15E attack jet streaked across the drone's high-definition field of vision and dropped a 500-pound bomb on the crowd, swallowing it in a shuddering blast. As the smoke cleared, a few people stumbled away in search of cover. Then a jet tracking them dropped one 2,000-pound bomb, then another, killing most of the survivors. They go on to say in the article that the assessments of the airstrike were carried out by the same unit which called in the airstrike. This is a unit called Task Force 9, right? So it's basically like the police department investigating itself for police brutality. And of course, this unit rarely found problems with its own work. No conflict of interest there, I'm sure. After this investigation, the New York Times sent its findings to U.S. Central Command. This is the response that it got. The command acknowledged the strikes for the first time, saying 80 people were killed, but the airstrikes were justified. It said the bombs killed 16 fighters and 4 civilians. As for the other 60 people, the statement said it was not clear that they were civilians, in part because women and children in the Islamic State sometimes took up arms. Right, so according to the statement, they just assume that the other 60 people they murdered were maybe combatants because sometimes women and children under Daesh took up arms. Well, it turns out this was also a lie, because in the article, people who saw the drone footage say there weren't 16 men at all. It was 2 or 3 men who were just walking around. They weren't even in combat. Now, this American unit, Task Force 9, was just going around Syria, murdering civilians, and then claiming it was self-defense. They see a car driving, they just claim it looks threatening, and then they call in an airstrike. Oh, we saw someone with a gun, call in an airstrike. They would lie and make up all sorts of things, anything to pretend that they were acting in self-defense. They actually did this so much that about 80% of all airstrikes called in by this unit were claimed in self-defense. And you can guess, of course, what that leads to. Thousands and thousands of civilians killed. In the article, they say that, quote, a number of Syrian towns, including the regional capital, Raqqa, were reduced to little more than rubble. Human rights organizations reported that the coalition caused thousands of civilian deaths during the war. Hundreds of military assessment reports examined by the Times show the task force was implicated in nearly 1 in 5 coalition civilian casualty incidents in the region. This Task Force 9 was killing so many people that even the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, that has killed God knows how many people in assassinations, wars, and coups around the world, grew alarmed. CIA officers alleged that in about 10 incidents, the secretive task force hit targets knowing civilians would be killed. And then the rest of the article, they go into detail of how people like Colonel Corsack and Mr. Tate tried raising the alarm that a war crime had been committed, only to be ignored and stonewalled. At one point, they even fired Tate from the Inspector General's office and escorted him out of the building by security because he wouldn't stop raising the issue of this massacre.
Yes, I think you're right to say that it's one of the massacres, but this particular one, which came out in the New York Times, is of a village which is right on the border of Syria and Iraq at the Euphrates, just below Al-Bukamal, which is normally spoken of as the major town near the border there. And that's been a critical, it's been a hot point. Now, the U.S. claims now that this was part of their final operations against ISIS. But this is a facade, because we know really they have been backing covertly ISIS for many, many years. Joe Biden admitted it 7 years ago. He admitted it indirectly, that his close Arab allies were financed, and the head of the U.S. military at that time, General Martin Dempsey, admitted that his close Arab allies were financing ISIS. And I myself went to a site in Deir ez-Zor 4 years ago, where the year before the U.S. and the Australians had bombed the Syrian army to allow ISIS to take over the mountain behind the airport at Deir ez-Zor. Now, the one we're talking about now, Al-Baghuz village, is on the Euphrates. It was March 2019, so in other words, more than a year after all of the major operations were finished against ISIS, that ISIS was driven out of all of the major towns and cities of Iraq and Syria. And that was announced by General Qasem Soleimani, you might remember, who was the leader of that project, and also, by the way, the leader who decided to go from, after the liberation of Deir Ezzor city from Daesh in October 2017, it was Soleimani that decided to go on immediately, straight away, down through Al-Ma'idin, down to Al-Bukumal, and take control of the border there. And that border site, around this village where we're talking about now, where the massacre took place, where the U.S. admits the massacre took place, is where Iran has set up some facilities, some security facilities, which has been attacked many, many times by unknown forces, but presumably Israelis and U.S. There's been missile strikes many, many times on the Iraqi and Syrian side of that border, the border crossing, which of course is the one border crossing that Syria and Iraq are still controlling, but it's under heavy fire. Now, it just so happens, Al-Baghouz is right at that point. So there wasn't really, there certainly are bands of ISIS still around eastern Syria, but they've been effectively sheltered by the U.S. occupation of eastern Syria. And to some extent, the I was told this in Hasakeh, that the Qassab, the SDF groups, which have a lot of ISIS prisoners, let groups out from time to time to go down for operations down near Deir Ezzor and down in southeastern Syria. In fact, there was a petition by prisoners in one of the jails there. There was a type of insurrection, and they were demanding to go down to Al-Tanf base, the U.S. base, on the border of Syria, Jordan, and Iraq, because they thought the conditions were better down there, and the U.S. was going to allow them to, you know, participate in some other sort of operations there.
The United States claims that they're fighting ISIS during this time. I mean, they claim the same thing in Iraq, and we can see what happened to Mosul, to Raqqa also. I mean, they flattened these cities, really, and they've committed atrocities, war crimes, but they seem to get away with it, right? And there's this sort of hypocrisy here where when Syria is fighting terrorists, they say that Syria is indiscriminately killing civilians, but we don't hear that about the United States, right? It's as if it's there's always a good enough reason for them to do that. Do you feel there's a double standard there in how this is treated by the media and the politicians?
Well, certainly as regards the Western media, I mean, because they're very deeply embedded with the Western states, aren't they? Effectively, it's not permissible in Western countries to contradict fundamentally the narrative that the U.S. has re-entered Iraq, for example, to fight ISIS. That has been a pretext. Of course, from time to time, they bomb people, they kill people. Also in Idlib, to some extent, every now and then they say they've killed an al-Qaeda leader there. But we know that NATO as a whole has been funneling aid and arms into that other side of northern Syria. I just make one other point about the Al-Baghouz, this village. As I said, Soleimani and the Syrian forces took control of that area and that border crossing in late 2017, just as the major occupation of ISIS was defeated. Now, that is the area that's been attacked many, many times. So ask yourself, 15, 16 months after that, when the Iranians, the Syrians, the Iraqi resistance were embedded in that area, why would there be any ISIS target there for the U.S. to bomb? This is really, there wouldn't be a large aggregation of ISIS in that area anyway, because it's an area controlled specifically by the three powers, like Iran, Iraq, Syria. And of course, the incident that I documented a few years earlier around Deir Ezzor was similar in a way. It shed some light on this. It was a case where the US and Australians, and I think the Danes, some others, went in, bombed the mountain behind Deir Ezzor, which was controlled by the Syrian army, killed over 120 Syrian soldiers, claimed it was a mistake. It was a well-planned operation. But that operation allowed ISIS to take over the mountain to get strategic advantage at a time when there's still a battle going on for the city. This is in September 2016. Now, the U.S. didn't come back and bomb ISIS on that mountain. They were very happy to leave ISIS there. And, of course, as it turns out, they failed. They couldn't take over Deir Ezzor city. So all of those operations in that part of Syria have been really clouded by this false pretext that the U.S. was there fighting ISIS. I spoke to a senior general in Deir Ezzor 4 years ago, General Shahada, and I said to him after he was explaining how, and this was reported in the Iraqi and the Iranian media a great deal, but of course not in the Western media, that there were these constant observations of collaboration between the U.S. occupation and ISIS at that time. But there was one other incident, and that was, he said, that a group of Syrian soldiers were attacked and killed in the desert on one occasion there in 2017. And it was not possible that they could have detected them without satellite intelligence. So they believe that the US was providing satellite intelligence to ISIS too. And so I asked him if he thought he was fighting a US commander, and he said 100% that the US was directing ISIS operations at that time. That's what the Syrians think.
It's absolutely incredible, all these examples. You know, it's almost too hard to believe, but this is effectively what's going on. Professor, just perhaps as a last question, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but, you know, in Afghanistan, just when the U.S. was withdrawing from Kabul, you know, they drone-striked the Ahmadi family and claimed it was an accident after investigating themselves. And then here again, the United States military investigates itself and finds no wrongdoing.
No, of course not. But this is what they do, isn't it? I mean, it's just they will always do it. You may recall the George Bush the